From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
When we first approached the Marines with this evidence, they responded in quite a hostile fashion. They accused us of buying into enemy propaganda. That aroused our suspicions even further because it seemed to be excessively hostile on their part.
As 8 Marines are charged in connection with the killing of 24 Iraqis in the town of Haditha last year, we'll speak to the reporter who exposed the massacre. We'll also talk to a woman recovering from AVM, the same brain condition suffered by South Dakota Senator Tim Johnson.
Tim Johnson is going to sleep a lot, but he's going to feel very fine later.
And we'll talk to Ian Williams, UN correspondent for The Nation magazine, on Kofi Annan's legacy, the new Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. And as we start this holiday weekend, we'll talk about Ian Williams' new book, Rum, A Social and Sociable History of the Real Spirit of 1776. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. 8 U.S. Marines have been charged in connection with the killing of 24 Iraqis in the town of Haditha last year. Marine Colonel Stuart Navarre announced the charges Thursday at Camp Pendleton in California.
Investigations. Various charges have been preferred against 4 Marines relating to the deaths of the Iraqi civilians on 19 November 2005. Also, charges have been preferred against 4 Marines for failure to properly report and or investigate the deaths of the Iraqi civilians. These charges include murder, dereliction of duty, false official statement, and obstruction of justice.
The victims were asleep the night of November 20th, 2005, when Marines burst into their homes and shot them dead. The military initially claimed 15 civilians died in a roadside blast caused by insurgents. In announcing the charges Thursday, the Marines acknowledged the claim was false. We'll have more on the Haditha charges after headlines. In Iraq, Defense Secretary Robert Gates continued his inaugural visit Thursday with meetings with Iraq's prime minister and other top officials. Gates' visit has coincided with increasing reports the Bush administration is gearing up to send more troops to Iraq. Gates denied getting into specifics with his Iraqi counterparts.
I can say that no numbers of additional troops or of troops were discussed. The focus was mainly on an overall approach, and including the possibility of some additional assistance. But as I say, we really didn't discuss any numbers. We were really talking in broader terms than that.
Iraq's Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki later said he has no opinion on an influx of U.S. troops and that U.S. military leaders should decide. In other Iraq news, 4 U.S. troops were killed in Anbar province Thursday. At least 70 U.S. service members have died this month, now on pace to become one of the deadliest of the Iraq War. Meanwhile, Iraq's the world's deadliest country for journalists for the 4th consecutive year. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, more than half of 55 murders of journalists worldwide took place in Iraq. The New York Times has published a controversial White House-censored article critical of U.S. policy towards Iran. The Bush administration had blocked the piece on the grounds it contains classified information. The op-ed is co-authored by former National Security Council official Flint Leverett. The New York Times did not defy the White House censorship and published the piece in redacted form. Leverett has argued the White House demanded the removal of sections detailing publicly known information about how Iran cooperated after the 9/11 attacks and offered to negotiate a diplomatic settlement 3 years ago. In an accompanying statement, Leverett writes he'll continue to campaign for the article's publication without White House censorship. Meanwhile, at the UN, the Security Council is preparing to vote on a new resolution threatening sanctions if Iran fails to halt uranium enrichment. On Thursday, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice predicted tough consequences for Iranian defiance.
I am quite satisfied and quite certain that the resolution that will be adopted will be one that both says to Iran, you cannot defy the international community, and imposes penalties on Iran for that defiance. I just want to underscore a Chapter 7 resolution puts Iran in some very unwelcome company in terms of the international community, in terms of the decisions that people will make about Iran as a partner in the international economy. And that, more than anything, is the importance of this resolution.
In Somalia, thousands of people have fled their homes today amid escalating fighting between Ethiopian-backed government forces and the Somalia Islamic Courts Council. The Islamic Courts control much of Somalia and are now fighting to expel Ethiopian troops from the last remaining government stronghold north of the capital, Mogadishu. On Thursday, the Islamic Courts leader said Somalia is now in a state of war. In Turkmenistan, President Sapurmurad Niyazov died on Thursday from a heart attack. Observers are widely expecting a power struggle over who will control the gas-rich country. Niyazov was known as an authoritarian who jailed opponents and constructed lavish tributes to his rule. In economic news, an external audit has concluded the World Bank has downplayed or ignored its own evidence when promoting policies favorable to neoliberal globalization. According to the Financial Times, the audit says the World Bank has often used research without taking a balanced view of the evidence. And in other international news, the rescue that wasn't. 31 years after the murder of five Australian journalists in East Timor, Indonesian troops, the Australian government, has revealed a special forces rescue mission was called off just 3 days before their deaths. The journalists were killed on the orders of Indonesian generals. Government sources say the special forces were waiting at Australia's Darwin Airport for approval to sneak into East Timor and carry out the rescue. But the mission was called off after high-level government officials failed to approve it. Approximately 2 days later, Australian television correspondent Greg Shackleton and his crew filed what would be their last report.
Why, they ask, are the Indonesians invading us? Why, they ask, if the Indonesians believe that Fretilin is communist, do they not send a delegation to Dili to find out? Why, they ask, are the Australians not helping us? When the Japanese invaded, they did help us. Why, they ask, are the Portuguese not helping us? We're still a Portuguese colony. Who, they ask, will pay for the terrible damage to our homes? My main answer was that Australia would not send forces here. That's impossible. However, I said we could ask that Australia raise this fighting at the United Nations. That was possible. At that, the second in charge rose to his feet, exclaimed, "Camarada journalist," shook my hand, the rest shook my hand, and we were applauded because we are Australians. That's all they want, for the United Nations to care about what is happening here.
Australian television correspondent Greg Shackleton. One day after Shackleton filed this report, the Indonesian soldiers killed him and his four-man crew. It was October of 1975. Back in the United States, the Department of Homeland Security has admitted for the first time a stalled program to monitor domestic air passengers violated federal privacy law. The program, called Secure Flight, has been used to screen passengers against terrorism watch lists. A review by the Homeland Security Privacy Office found the program broke the law because it failed to disclose passenger information was gathered from commercial brokers. In New Jersey, Governor John Corzine signed legislation Thursday granting gay couples the right to civil unions. New Jersey will become the third state to offer gay civil unions when the law goes into effect in February. And finally, Democracy Now! Producer Elizabeth Press is in Oaxaca, Mexico, covering the popular uprising against the state governor Ulises Ruiz. She filed this report.
On Wednesday, 91 prisoners were transferred from the federal prison in Tepic, Nayarit, to Cerezo, the state prison here in Oaxaca. Friends, family, and human rights observers gathered outside the prison as rumor had it that the prisoners would be released on Thursday. Selena Marina waited for her brother, who was detained on November 25th, to be released, but he was not among the 14.
Me siento triste, preocupada.
I feel sad and worried because we don't know when they will release them, since, as they said earlier, this is political. So we are subject to the decisions made by governmental groups when here they are playing with human lives, while there are people with feelings who need to see their families and be with them.
This was on the eve of the International Day of Solidarity with the people of Oaxaca, called for by the EZLN. For the living reappearances of the disappeared,
for the freedom of the detained, for the exit of Ulysses Ruiz and the federal forces from Oaxaca, for the punishment of those guilty of torture, rape, and murder. Protests are scheduled all over the world today, including here in Oaxaca City.
We will participate in the march, because when they ask us if we Oaxacans are afraid, yes, we are afraid. But our indignation and anger are even greater, because this is not the way to treat a people who are asking for justice. And we do not rise up because we're troublemakers, as they call us here, but rather because the people are hungry, the people are needy. Yes, we will participate in the march.
For Democracy Now!, this is Elizabeth Press in Oaxaca City.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we broadcast from our temporary new studios at the Firehouse at DCTV. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. 8 U.S. Marines have been charged in connection with the killing of 24 Iraqis in the town of Haditha last year. The victims were asleep the night of November 20, 2005, when Marines burst into their homes and shot them dead. The military initially claimed 15 civilians had died in a roadside blast caused by insurgents. Human rights activists have described the killings in Haditha as perhaps the worst case of deliberate killing of Iraqi civilians by U.S. service members since the war began. Soon after the incident, the mayor of Haditha led an angry delegation up to a nearby Marine camp to seek redress. Their protests were ignored, and the U.S. military stood by its original contention that the civilians were killed by a roadside bomb. The story would have ended there had it not been taken up by Time magazine.
Time obtained a videotape shot in Haditha by an Iraqi journalism student one day after the attack. The tape shows that many of the victims, especially the women and children, were still in their nightclothes when they died. The scenes from inside the houses show the walls and ceilings are pockmarked with shrapnel, bullet holes, and blood. In January, Time presented a copy of the video along with witness testimony to U.S. military command in Baghdad. A preliminary military investigation was launched. It established the men, women, and children were indeed killed by the Marines, though it described the deaths as collateral damage. Earlier this year, Aparashim Ghosh, the chief international correspondent for Time magazine, joined us on Democracy Now! To talk about Haditha.
We looked into this case, and the more we dug, the more we thought that something didn't quite add up. And when we finally got our hands on this videotape, it became very clear to us that these people could not have been killed outdoors by an explosive device. They were killed in their homes, in their nightclothes. The nightclothes are significant because Iraqi women and children especially are very, very unlikely to go outdoors wearing their nightclothes. It is a very conservative society. When we first approached the Marines with this evidence, they responded in quite a hostile fashion. They accused us of buying into enemy propaganda. That aroused our suspicions even further because it seemed to be excessively hostile on their part. And we dug even more. We spoke to witnesses. We spoke to survivors of this incident. And then we became quite convinced that these people were killed by the Marines. What is left to be seen is whether they were killed in the course of the Marine operation as collateral damage or by accident, or whether the Marines went on a rampage after one of their own had been killed and killed these people in revenge.
You're very graphic in the piece, One Morning in Haditha. Describe what the survivors say happened when the U.S. military went into the nearby houses around where the roadside bomb had exploded.
Well, the survivors claim, let me back up a little bit. The Marines claim that they received small arms fire from nearby homes and that they responded to this fire, they shot back, and then they went into the homes to try and flush out the bad guys, the terrorists who were in there. It's clear from the video that those homes don't have any bullet marks outside, which would suggest that there was very little, if any, shooting by the Marines at the facades of these homes. But there are lots of signs of bullets inside. The victims told us that the Marines came in and they killed everybody in sight. In one house, they threw a grenade into a kitchen. That set off a propane tank and nearly destroyed the kitchen and killed several people in that home. The scenes that were described by the survivors and the witnesses were incredibly bloody and very graphic, but they're unfortunately very commonplace in Iraq.
Inside, you talk to you have the description of a 9-year-old girl.
Yes.
Tell us about her and her family and what she says happened.
Well, she was indoors with her family when the explosion took place. The explosion was loud enough to wake everybody up in the neighborhood.
The bomb that killed the Marine.
The first explosion, yes. And she says when she heard gunshots, of course, she's a child. She was frightened. When the Marines stormed towards their home, her grandfather slipped into the next room, as his apparently was his custom, to pray, to reach out for the family Quran and pray to God that this crisis would pass. On this occasion, the Marines came into the home. They entered the room where the grandfather was and other members of the family and killed him.
And she was left alive?
She survived, yes.
And her little brother?
And her brother was injured by a piece of, either by a bullet or a piece of shrapnel, we're not sure.
But her parents, her mother, her father, her grandparents?
Her grandparents, I believe her uncle, were also killed.
And then another house?
4 houses in all, involving a total of, indoors, total of 19 people and 4 people outside.
Parashim Ghosh, the chief international correspondent for Time magazine. He joined us in our studio last March. You can go to our website at democracynow.org to watch, listen to, or read the transcript of the full interview. Juan?
Well, more than a week has passed since Democratic Senator Tim Johnson of South Dakota underwent emergency brain surgery. Johnson suffered bleeding in his brain caused by a rare condition known as congenital arteriovenous malformation, or AVM. It causes arteries and veins to grow abnormally large. The arteries become tangled and sometimes burst. Johnson was hospitalized 9 days ago after a conference call with reporters where he began to slur his words and stammer.
The money was proposed to be provided a year ago. It's frustrating that.
Soon afterwards, Johnson was taken to the hospital. Senator Johnson's doctors say he remains in critical condition and is being kept sedated to aid his recovery from the brain surgery. His recovery could decide who controls the Senate. If he were to resign or die, the Republican governor of South Dakota, Mike Rounds, would be able to pick a Republican to replace him, thus giving the GOP control of the Senate. But as long as Johnson is alive, the Democratic majority will likely remain intact because there's no rule requiring that a senator must be on Capitol Hill for every vote. The Senate has never ousted a member over poor health. In 1969, another South Dakota senator, Carl Mundt, suffered a stroke. He never appeared in the Senate again, but remained in office through 1972. In the 1940s, Senator Carter Glass of Virginia suffered heart trouble and was absent for 4 full years.
Today, we're going to look not at the politics surrounding Johnson's illness, but the illness itself. Donna Capella joins us now. Donna suffered a congenital arteriovenous malformation 1.5 years ago. She is the former business manager here at Downtown Community Television. Also with us is her husband, Frederick Soule.
We welcome you both to Democracy Now!, and it's great to have you with us. And it's great, Donna, that you are in good enough health to be able to come back to work. Can you describe what happened to you and when it happened?
I was here at DCTV in a conference meeting, and I felt hot and burning, and I thought it was throwing up. So I excused myself, and I went to see Keiko Tsuno, who is a co-founder, and she called her husband, who's another co-founder, John Albert, and they put me in the car. They gave me a bag to throw up in, and I went to the emergency room.
And at that point, did they understand in the emergency room what had happened to you?
No. It took a couple of days for them to say maybe it's a stroke or maybe it's a brain thing. But then I went to the hospital and they said No, they didn't know what was happening there. So then they did an MRI angiogram, and they found the AVM then.
Well, we're going to go to break, and we come back. We'll continue to talk to you, Donna, and your husband, Fred Soule, about what this year and a half of your recovery, of learning to do everything again, as well as speak, what this has been like. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Back in a minute. The international radar here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're talking with Donna Capella, who is the business manager here at DCTV. A year and a half ago, she suffered a congenital intravenous malformation, a rare brain condition that causes internal bleeding of the brain. It is the same condition that South Dakota Senator Tim Johnson is suffering from right now. Frederick Soule is also with us, Donna Capella's husband. Fred, talk about the beginning for you. We hear what Donna was going through. What did you understand was happening?
Well, we went through all the tests, and they discovered the AVM, and they tried to do a process called embolization, which is kind of glues it shut and is not as invasive as regular brain surgery. She was in that process for about 4 hours, and the surgeon just couldn't get to it where it was. That was on a Friday night. She was scheduled for a craniotomy on the following Tuesday. On Monday, she had a real serious bleeding episode, and they had to do the surgery in emergency on that Monday night. So obviously, there was a lot of consternation and angst about that with me and her family, but we had wonderful surgeons and doctors. They informed us exactly what was going on. The surgery took about 6 hours, and you know, she was in the neuro ICU after that for about 3 weeks, and then went to Kessler in East Orange for rehabilitation for about a month.
And when she came out of the surgery, what did the doctors tell you was the prognosis in terms of her recovery or her chances?
They said they couldn't really tell at that time, but she was obviously going to have to go through a lot of rehabilitation. Her particular AVM was in the cerebellum, which is kind of good news because the cerebellum can regenerate itself, but it does take a lot of intense therapy and rehabilitation. In Donna's case, it affected more the motor part of the body and the coordination, swallowing, speech, things like that. It didn't affect the cognitive learning processes. So in a way, that was good news.
The news reports say that Senator Johnson's AVM is also in the cerebellum. Now, how do you relearn, Donna? What is it that you lost the ability to do and then started to go through the therapy to regain?
Well, I relearned by practicing everything. I lost everything. My ability to walk, to talk, to eat with my mouth closed, everything, to see, to smell, to yawn, I lost everything. But I practice every day. I practice and practice and practice.
The doctors are saying you're about a year ahead?
Yes.
In terms of rehabilitating?
Yes, because originally they said 2 years, but most people don't practice and don't do the exercises, so I'm a year ahead of schedule. I came back to here in March, which is 6, 7, 8 months later. I worked one day, now I work 3 days here. So if you practice, you can do anything.
And when you said you lost these abilities, when you came out of the surgery, would the therapist basically had to recontact with you or get your attention to be able to begin these exercises? How did it actually work?
That's exactly right. They talked to me. They said, they told me everything to do, and I did what they said. Most people don't do what the therapists say, but you have to do. You do what they say. You do what the doctor says.
Now, last week, you were busy faxing letters to the Johnson family. Why?
I want them, especially before the holiday, do not fret to not be happy, but be calm, because he lives through this. So he's going to live, and it's going to take a long time. I want them to call me because I survived. He can survive. Anybody can survive. I want them to not fret. I don't want them.
And Fred, in terms of the willpower of your wife through all of this to overcome it. Can you talk about her experience from your perspective on this?
Yeah, Donna's always been one who sets goals. I mean, when she came home from therapy, she was in a wheelchair. She had to be taken to bed. You know, meals had to be brought to her.
She had a patch over her eye, didn't she?
She had a patch over her eye because of vision problems, which ultimately corrected themselves, but she had trouble, so she couldn't read and things like that. My daughter lives in Switzerland and was coming over with our grandchildren for Christmas, and she had vowed that she was going to be able to walk upstairs and, you know, get around by that that time frame. And, you know, sure enough, she did. You know, she wasn't using a walker, she wasn't using a wheelchair. Sometimes it would take her half an hour to go up the stairs, but she would do it. So she sets short-term goals for herself, reach them, and then set another one.
And what about her memory and her recollection of other people?
Her memory is fine. She doesn't have a lot of memory of the 3 weeks that she was in the neurosurgical ICU. She doesn't have a whole lot of memory of the therapy, but things before that and history and all the cognitive skills, they're all there. Matter of fact, I think they're even better than they were before.
What do you mean?
Well, she tended to be a little unorganized before the surgery. Now she's a lot more organized.
I don't want to cause any family feud here.
Really, I'm going to kill him.
So,
any words of advice, Fred, that you have for the Johnson family going through similar situations?
You just have to be supportive. You have to understand what they're going through. It's a lot like, you know, I have a 4-year-old granddaughter who is learning a lot of the things that Donna had to relearn. So it's kind of interesting, but it's going to happen. You just work hard and be supportive, and she'll come. They'll come through it.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Donna Capella, again, suffers the same condition that Senator Tim Johnson suffers, the senator from South Dakota. Donna suffering from AVM and recovering. This is a year and a half into her recovery. She works here at Downtown Community Television in New York. Fred Soule is her husband, works at Lehman Brothers. Thanks so much for joining
us.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
As we turn now to the next story of the day, and that's the United Nations. Juan?
At the United Nations, the South Korean diplomat Ban Ki-moon is preparing to become the next Secretary General, replacing Kofi Annan, who has served since 1996. Ban Ki-moon officially assumes the role on January 1. Ban Ki-moon will become the first Asian to lead the world body in 35 years. In his last weeks in office, Kofi Annan has repeatedly criticized the Bush administration's foreign policy and the invasion of Iraq.
I hope that when next time one is dealing with a broader threat to the international community, one will wait and seek the approval of the Security Council. As I've said, a government, a country has a right to defend itself. But when it's an issue of broader threat to the international community, it's only the Security Council that has that legitimacy to authorize action on that basis.
Kofi Annan also criticized the international community's response to the situation in Darfur.
I'm under tremendous pressure from the international community to cooperate with that community to send in troops to help. Have we done all that we could to pressure the government of Sudan to do what it has to do? There are measures short of force that could be used. We've used them in other situations. Political pressure, economic sanctions, and isolation. And of course, in the last resort, there is the use of force. Have we brought to bear on this situation all the capacity we have to pressure the government to bend?
Kofi Annan also warned a U.S. attack on Iran would be unwise and disastrous. Meanwhile, at his swearing-in ceremony last week, Ban Ki-moon outlined his vision of the United Nations.
By strengthening the three pillars of the United Nations, security, development, and human rights, we can build a more peaceful, more prosperous, and more just world for our succeeding generations. As we pursue our collective endeavor to reach that goal, my first priority will be to restore trust. I will seek to act as a harmonizer and bridge builder.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. For more on Kofi Annan and Ban Ki-moon, we have Eoin Williams here in the studio. He's the UN correspondent for The Nation magazine. His article, Annan's Principled Pragmatism, appears in the new issue of the magazine. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
It's very good to have you with us. Talk about Kofi Annan, the last decade.
I think he was a surprise. This is an impossible job. He's got to be a diplomat, he's got to be a standard setter, and if he's too censorious, if he goes to Ariel Sharon and says, you're a bloodthirsty murderer, he can't talk to him the following day. So, I mean, there's always this balance about whether, and the tightrope walk about, you know, did he say things strongly enough? Because he always said very moral things, he laid it down, For example, about the Iraq war, I mean, he had to be badgered into saying that it was illegal.
Ian Williams, we're going to go to break, and then we're going to come back and join the correspondent for The Nation magazine at the United Nations. Stay with us. Now, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, and we are on our inaugural day of our temporary new studio, so thank you so much for bearing with us. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We are broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on NPR and Pacifica stations, on low-power FM, college and community radio stations. We're also broadcasting on public access TV and PBS TV stations and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our guest today is Ian Williams. He is the correspondent for The Nation magazine at the United Nations and has written a piece called Annan's Principled Pragmatism. He's also written a book on rum, and we're going to get to that as we move into this holiday weekend. But first, your evaluation of Kofi Annan's legacy.
Well, I think almost accidentally, I think he is really going to be regarded as one of the great secretary generals, because it's this very peculiar mix that the job requires. His ability to talk to people who are pretty evil and yet lay down moral standards. And it's very difficult, you know, you can't roll in the gutter and come out without some dirt on you. And what he did, his sort of natural laid-back, very sort of quiet demeanour, allowed him to say things without being abusive and confrontational about it. But he always did say them. So he engaged the Israelis. At the same time, he did keep reminding them that international law says that what they were doing was wrong. He kept on talking to Bush and Colin Powell, even though he kept laying down quietly that the war was illegal, that they shouldn't have gone to war without Security Council support, and that the justification was, as we now know, rather tenuous.
And Ian, ironically, he came in as the U.S. candidate for Secretary General.
It's difficult to remember that now, isn't it?
Increasingly, he appeared, especially in the years after the leading up to the invasion of Iraq, to rankle the administration in many ways, didn't he?
Well, almost anyone is. I was asked about Ban Ki-moon, for example, how long would his honeymoon last? And basically, it doesn't take long between being sworn in as Secretary General and being sworn at in Fox TV in Washington, because he's standing for things that the administration finds inconvenient. You know, the Secretary General has to represent the international community, 191 countries, and international law.
And we know that Washington, especially this administration, but even the previous one, often really wasn't that concerned about what the rest of the world thought or about international law when it went against domestic interests. So whoever holds that job, if he's going to do the job properly, is going to run athwart of Washington.
And your article also goes into the impact of the Secretary General most recently in a conflict in Lebanon and his ability to sort of forge a solution to what looked to be a growing crisis.
Yeah, that was because both sides trusted him. They thought this was someone that they could do business. And also he was proactive because he was quiet and laid back. But he actually, I don't think in previous years the Secretary General would have had the temerity to start constructing a peace proposal to get the troops in line for the reinforced UNIFIL without the go-ahead from the Security Council. But basically, he was crafting this package at a time when Tony Blair and George Bush were telling the world that we didn't need a ceasefire. And, you know, it's patently absurd. If you've got thousands of people being killed and bombs raining down, everybody knows a ceasefire is exactly what you want. To say it's premature is bloodthirsty, callous, or stupid, or all of the three. But he was there, and he said, we need a ceasefire, and he crafted the means to do it. And, I mean, just think 10 years ago, Israeli-American policy for 15 years now has been to keep the UN out of the Middle East problem. And the Israelis were basically pleading with him for help in climbing down the pole that they'd climbed up into.
Ian Williams, his term was bookended, Kofi Annan's, by two genocides, Rwanda at the beginning, Darfur now at the end. Can you talk about Kofi Annan's role in both?
Well, it wasn't just Rwanda. I mean, he was also a prominent figure in peacekeeping at the time of Srebrenica. And you know, his the easy let out there, by the way, is it was Clinton's presidential directive that said there would be no more peacekeeping forces, no reinforcement and no more money for the peacekeeping force in Rwanda. That's the real culpability, which everybody forgets now. And certainly, I mean, he was a cog in a machine. And he hated it, I think. And that's when he came. And he was serious about never again. The reports that he did on Srebrenica, that he commissioned on Srebrenica in Rwanda, were pretty merciless about the UN's institutional failings. Basically because they did what they were told, rather than upholding, you know, international standards. That they were going along with the convenience of Washington and Europe in both places. And with Darfur, once again, in a quiet way, what he has been saying about the Sudanese government is unprecedented for a Secretary General, who always defer to the member states. But he has repeatedly gone on about the Sudanese government and saying, you know, you can't do this, you're breaking international law. He sent inspectors who've come back with these reports, and he's been prodding the member states to do something about it. And, you know, in this context, I think the most significant thing that he did, which I think is really going to make the history books, is last year he got 191 countries to agree, heads of state, to the responsibility to protect, which basically rips up international law. They've now reinterpreted international law to say that when a country commits mayhem against its own citizens, it's an international responsibility to go and do something about it. That's a huge change because, you know, in the past, when you murdered people, the international law said, hey, ain't nobody's business what you do.
What about the whole issue of the internal workings of the United Nations itself, the corruption scandals, the scandals with peacekeepers abusing populations in some areas? How well did Kofi Annan handle those issues?
As well as he could under the saying. I mean, more promptly. First of all, the tendency in the past would have been to deny them, and they actually did things about them. And remember, with the peacekeeping, these aren't troops under UN command. These are countries send their own military detachments. So the UN doesn't have that much control over their behavior or their what all they can do, the secretary can do, is to push those countries into exercising military discipline on their troops. And I think, you know, the corruption stories, look, they're grossly exaggerated. The oil for food is a classic. $10 billion was handed over from the oil for food program to the Iraqi occupation, to the US occupation. No one has discovered where that money has gone. $10 billion went to people like Halliburton. The Bowen, a Bush crony, in fact, has spent four or five years now trying to find out where that $10 billion of oil for food money went. It's never mentioned in that context. Oil for food is the UN scandal. The UN scandal was allegedly the head of that took $140,000. He denies it. And he didn't take it from the fund. He took it allegedly as commission. He says it was his own money. And the reason they found out about it was he declared it over 4 years. But 140,000 versus 10 billion, and see how much fuss is made of it. There are people on the conservative Republican side who think that the UN is a threat to American sovereignty and the ability of the administration to do what it wants when it wants. So it's always going to be under attack.
Where does Kofi Annan go now after a decade of being Secretary General, and who is Ban Ki-moon?
Well, Kofi's claiming he's going to spend some time in Ghana. Most of us think he's going to get very bored very quickly. But he's going to spend time between Europe and Switzerland, yes, and in Ghana, his home patch, which he hasn't been to for a long time, apart from visiting. And Ban Ki-moon is an interesting character. In many ways, he's very like Kofi. He's quiet, laid back. You know, he's not confrontational. But I was impressed before during his campaign, which was unprecedented that they had campaigns, I asked him about the International Criminal Court. And now, knowing that John Bolton has very strong views on the International Criminal Court and has a veto, he could have said, well, of course, I will follow what the decisions of the United Nations or the international community. He didn't. He said, I support the International Criminal Court. And so he picks his words very carefully. When he says that, he's basically saying, I have principles and I don't care who knows it. And he's in some ways remarkably lively. We had him at the annual correspondence dinner, and he did Frank Sinatra imitations. Ban Ki-moon is coming to town, which was a bit of a revelation to all of us. We weren't expecting this non-Confucian mode.
What about the issue of structural reform at the United Nations and greater power sharing of the people, especially the nations of the third world in the world body? How do you see that he'll move forward on that?
I'm not sure he can, really. I mean, this is, first of all, you've got to sort of decouple. When people talk about reforms, especially in Washington, what they mean is, how can we make this organization do what it's told? that's the beginning end of everything of reform, as far as Washington is concerned. How do we stop it passing anti-Israel resolutions? That's reform. The organization itself, as long as the U.S. and the other big powers actually appoint people inside the secretary, you can't have proper reform. And none of them. I mean, a few weeks ago, we actually a U.S. presidential patronage appointment for the head of the World Food Program, a former editor of the Washington Times. You know, this is a very questionable appointment, but basically, I understand they were told, by the way, we'll cut our contributions to the World Food Program unless you appoint her. And that's not reform. That's part of the spoil system. On the Security Council, look, pragmatically, I think the non-aligned has got to accept some responsibility here. As long as they send yes countries along as temporary members, then they're not going to have as much influence. And I don't really think that adding new permanent members is a solution. It's as though the solution to the British House of Lords when it was hereditary was to double the number of hereditary peers. You don't sort of make something that's wrong righter by doubling the amount of it. You need proper accountability on the part of the members who are already there.
Ann Williams, we're going to switch gears as we move into this holiday weekend and talk about, well, your latest book. Kieran's going to bring in some of the product that we're talking about. But your book is called Rum, A Social and Sociable History of the Real Spirit of 1776. Why did you spend your last years writing about rum, and what have you got on the table here?
Well, this is the fun one. This is contraband people. This is Havana Club, 7-year-old, that Bacardi and the U.S. Congress have spent years trying to stamp out. And it's very popular in Europe because people like to think they're cocking a snook at Uncle Sam every time they have a drink. And this is Mount Gay from Barbados, which is where I discovered rum was founded. It was discovered. My revelation on this was based on being in Martinique on another project and suddenly realizing that in the 18th century, the Caribbean was the equivalent to the Persian Gulf. This is where hundreds of thousands of people went and died because it was the source of liquid wealth. It was rum and sugar that basically developed New England, developed the Atlantic seaboard, and gave Britain its commercial prominence in the 18th century. It was the money from rum and sugar that produced the British national debt, which until George Bush came along was the biggest in the history of the world. They financed their wars with the profits of the sugar.
And your book suggests that the American Revolution was more about rum than it was about tea or...
Indisputable. I mean, you know, look, not even the British fight wars about Earl Grey. And the tea was actually duty-free. Samuel Adams and the others were smugglers. The Boston Tea Party was a bunch of smugglers who had warehouses full of smuggled tea that was about to be undercut by duty-free tea that the East India Company was bringing in. That's why they threw it overboard, because they couldn't rely on the good citizens of Boston to be patriotic enough to pay extra for the tea they had in the warehouses. And the real issue was that the Americans had been trading with the French for the whole of the 100 years of wars between Britain and France about Canada and the French presence there. And they didn't want to pay taxes on the molasses, which they used to make rum. And think of what New England did with that rum. They bought slaves with it. They used it to clear the Indians out of the West. They drank an awful lot of it themselves. It was a huge motor of the economy in New England, because the New Englanders took timber and cod down to the Caribbean and traded that for the molasses, which then they made into rum, which then they took to buy slaves with, and took the slaves to the southern colonies and to the Caribbean. It was a pretty sort of vicious trade, but New England was built up on it. There's not many actual resources in Massachusetts. You know, sort of, you can't grow many things. There's no mines. There's no oil. There were just fish.
And you're right. Rum was used by the colonists to clear Native American tribes and to buy slaves. How did they clear the tribes?
Well, basically, they made them dependent, because in the early days, the most important part was the fur trade. And, you know, the Indians would come in and they would buy, they would bring their furs in and get, you know, blankets, food, whatever goods they needed. But the rum was like cocaine. They wanted the rum badly. So first of all, they hunted out, you know, and actually clear cut, sort of in a sense, they trapped out all of the animals so they get more and more rum. And the rum had devastating social effects. I mean, this was a really potent substance unleashed on people who were not used to it. And, I mean, the Indians sort of... Apparently, it was an alibi for a murder if you were drunk, which I don't think would go down well in most courts nowadays. But the Indians, it was sort of almost a spiritual thing. They actually held people down and forced more rum down them. It really ruined the societies. It devastated them.
So, in other words, that famous scene in that classic Marlon Brando movie, Burn, where Jose Dolores, the rebel slave, introduces Brando, who's like a 18th century British CIA agent, in essence, to rum, and he introduces him to whiskey. It's apocryphal, in other words.
That part's apocryphal. It's a brilliant film, that. I mean, more people should see that. But it shows the importance of it at the time, of what was going on. And, I mean, this is the other part of rum's history. I mean, I'm enjoying this stuff, but when you think about sugar and rum and about the slave rebellions in Haiti and Guadeloupe and, I mean, the story of Haiti, it's just worth reading over and over again what happened. And
talk about it.
Well, when the slaves revolted, basically this was almost like Cambodia. First of all, the French Revolution freed the slaves, and then Napoleon tried to reintroduce slavery. And the only reason that Haiti had stayed French was that it was the black and slave-led armies which had fought the British and defeated them all that period. And they defended it for the revolution. And then Napoleon came back in and tried to reintroduce slavery, and they revolted against that. And, you know, for 20 or 30 years, the island was devastated with wars and counter-wars. And I think the most touching one is in Guadeloupe, which is, I've discovered in the course of this, and it should be better known. At one point, when Napoleon came in to reintroduce the slave system, a mixed regiment of white sans-culottes who come out from Paris, the half-breed sort of middle-class blacks and the slaves, actually blew themselves up in Guadeloupe rather than surrender to slavery. Now, that's one of the epic stories of human freedom. It's just not told. And, you know, it's another part of that story of rum, which... it got so fascinating. And I mean, I must say that I drank a lot more rum than was strictly necessary for the research. but it was fun while I was doing it.
Speaking of rum and revolution, you also get, obviously you talk about rum being the most popular spirit in the world, but one of the most famous of the rum companies, obviously, is Bacardi. And you deal a lot with the role of Bacardi in relationship to politics and revolution.
Well, Bacardi, I mean, I didn't know until I'd started researching this, and I don't think either Castro or Bacardi have advertised this, but Bacardi actually sent checks up to Castro and Che and the Sierra Maestra to finance their rebellion against Batista.
But you also say that Bacardi's origins are actually in Jamaica originally?
As far as I can tell, it was a Jamaican distiller who, after they abolished slavery in Jamaica in the 1830s in the British Empire, he moved to Cuba because they still had slaves there. The sugar was cheaper, the plantations were functioning, and set up a distillery, which it looks like the Bacardi family actually inherited, including the still itself. And the Bacardi family were actually rebels at one point. Your sort of commercial expertise outweighs their politics. It was a tot of Bacardi rum which revived the Crown Prince of Spain from his deathbed, and that they got the royal appointment for it. I've been pushing half facetiously rum as a sort of specific for avian flu. Tamiflu, double-blind tests show that it's not very effective, has bad side effects. Now, rum, 300 years of tradition in fighting colds and flu, and the side effects are entirely benign, right, in my experience.
And so Havana Club today, its relation to the embargo?
Well, what happened was that America, because Bacardi basically controls the Florida delegation too in Washington, Bacardi passed special, as basically every time they've lost in court, they've had a clause put into legislation in Washington to get it all back again. And they're ignoring the World Trade Organization. They have claimed the trademark on Havana Club from Cuba, which is recognized in the rest of the world. And they're actually trying to make Havana Club here. Even there, it's very dubious legally. And you can't import Cuban rum into the United States. It's because of the embargo. But in the rest of Europe, Pernod Ricard, in partnership with the Cubans, has been really selling it. It's one of the most popular rums and drinks in Europe. And as a lot of that is people wanting to sort of give the finger to Uncle Sam, because they know. But Fidel was not exactly honest on this one. When everything crashed, he was telling the Cubans they should stop drinking rum. It was bad for them. But the real reason was they couldn't get enough to supply the world markets.
What most surprised you about writing rum, since you knew a lot about it before you started?
I think it was just to see how it had grown and just how big the rum and sugar trade was. And, you know, it's these things that you take for granted. You take for granted that New England is industrialized, or that, you know, Britain was ruling the world.
This was the oil of the
18th century. Yes, it was liquidity in every sense.
And in a nutshell, how it's made?
What you do, you take sugar cane, the juices from the sugar cane, or the molasses left over after you've crystallized it, either will do, and you distill it. You ferment it, and then you distill it. And that gives a much more complex sort of set of mixture in the distillation than you get from whiskey or brandy. The secret is the aging. Rum, more than anything else, is it has to be aged in wood over a sort of reasonable period of time for it to be really good.
And what
good.
Does the wood do?
Well, it lets oxygen in and out. But also, I mean, all these brown spirits, this is something else I'd never really thought about before. All these brown spirits are brown because of the oak that they're kept in. It sort of takes the oak and the tannins. And when you have a really bad hangover, you have to remember that the tannins are what they use to tan leather, and that's what the drinks take out of the take out of the wood. But they used to think that you put them on a sea journey. That's what improved it. And then they realized that it wasn't the sea journey. It was storing it in the wooden casks, which made the difference.
Well, Ian Williams, I want to thank you for writing the book. I don't think we're going to take one of these bottles and crash it over, baptize our new soundboard. But I thank you for talking about the social and sociable history of the real spirit of 1776. The book is called Rum. Thanks very much, and happy holidays to you. And happy holidays to all of our listeners and viewers around the world. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkadoush, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Anna Nagara, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Mate. Very special thanks to Nick Marsilio and as well Mike DeFilippo and Uri Galed. We also want to thank Kevin Allen, our set designer, and Cheryl Thacker, our lighting designer, and the remarkable team who helped build this temporary studio. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.